Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I'm very excited to have Jonathan Braun on the show today. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello there. Very nice to be here.
It's great to have you. We are going to be talking about your father's amazing work and his inspiration with Eichler Homes and all things photography. And let's just jump right in. So your father was came from this beautiful artistic background, a family that loved art, had a painter who father and a mother who was a writer. And he explored all of these ways of showing the vibrance of life through photography. And as a kid, you experienced him in your own home, sharing these photos and creating these photos. Can you tell us a little bit about that world of being in the dark room with your father and experiencing that?
Yeah, Monique. So you're right. He was in a family where his father was a very noted impressionist painter, Maurice Braun. And so it was an artistic environment that he grew up in. And his father actually commented, I have a quote somewhere where he commented about how even at the young age of like four, had a great sense of color. And he could see that he was had artistic talents. So that was from an early age. And his uncle, like I think a lot of photographers got started with a relative giving him a camera. His uncle gave him a camera, which launched him into photography, and later on actually built his own enlarger. He was enterprising enough to have put that together so that he could, you know, make his own prints at home. And then I guess I'm straying from your question, but I'm giving a little bit of background here. Mm-hmm. He did go to college and studied journalism briefly for a couple of years in 1939, but then attended Art Center School in Los Angeles. That would have been 1943, but unfortunately was drafted into the infantry, into the army, in the middle of World War II. So he was sent to basic training and shipped over to Europe and wound up at a train station in France with his infantry troop to head off to the front. And everybody's name got called but his, and he was pulled aside. And the Signal Corps, the combat photography unit documenting the war, had high casualties, and they needed photographers, so he got reassigned to become a combat photographer. Mm. And so he spent the duration of the war right, you know, on the front lines, documenting, the battles and concentration camps and prisoners of war. In my family, we have this amazing book that he created. Of course, all the photos became the property of the U.S. government. But after the war, he was allowed to go back and make copies of some of these photos, which he put together in a spiral-bound book, and it held endless fascination, believe me, for a little boy, and actually for anybody, because it's just so real and so, you know, as it was.
Wow.
So, my parents met in New York right after the war and married, and there's a lot of backstory to this, but came to San Francisco and lived on Telegraph Hill for a while, just below Coit Tower. Mm-hmm. I remember him saying the rent was like $3 a month, like that. But discovered this little house in Marin County in a little town called San Anselmo and moved there in 1948. And so they bought one house very quickly, moved to the place next door, which had a little bit more space. And then that's where our family was and where we grew up. There were five kids, and they remodeled this old funky cabin three times and expanded it, and had the services of John Mathias, who's a very awesome designer and architect who he had met doing photography for Sunset Magazine. So John Mathias did all the remodels on the house, and it grew with the family, and that's where he had his office and studio and darkroom. And so that leads to your question. So, yeah, as a kid, you know, the door was always open, and not open, but available for us to go spend time in there with him. And I mean, I just found it incredibly fascinating to watch this, to be in the dark, and then under the glow of the safe light, you know, see these images appearing in a tray of developer. And all the technique, you know, involved in making the prints with the dodging and
all that. And it was very, very difficult back then. It's not like it is now with, you know, all of the advances or retouching. I mean, you took photos and that was it. I think when you're developing, you know, hopefully you came out with something good at the time.
That's really, really true. I mean, I think in the days now of the iPhone, where everybody, I think, thinks they're a photographer, you would have no clue what went into, you know, being a freelance commercial photographer in that time. I mean, even as simple as getting to the job. I mean, there was no GPS, and, you know, so just maybe people would be interested to know what went into, you know, doing an on-location assignment for a commercial photographer of that era. Now we're talking about the late 50s, 60s. I was born in the late 50s, and I was lucky enough to be allowed to go along on some of these on-location shoots as a young boy, and my job was usually to change, believe it or not, these big flash bulbs that were used. There was no electronic flash. All the lighting, the artificial lighting, was done with big, giant blue flash bulbs. And so every click of the shutter, somebody had to go around and change all the flash bulbs. You had to have a glove because they were very hot. But, you know, the day before would involve, so we in our pantry, we had a stand-up freezer that was dedicated just to film storage. So we would buy, you know, bulk film and put it in the freezer. So he always had a stockpile of film. And so he would go into the dark room and load the holders for the 4x5 film for his 4x5 camera, which a lot of these architectural shoots were done in 4x5, some with 2.25 format using Hasselblad camera. Not so much 35 millimeter, but occasionally 35 millimeter. Mm-hmm. So all this preparation would happen in advance of preparing the film, preparing the equipment. The equipment was heavy and bulky. You know, we live on a steep hill. There's 30 stairs up to the street. So all the heavy cases had to be lugged. And then it's off to the assignment and finding the location. And on any given shoot, there'd be a representative of the client. It could be an architect, might be a magazine, a corporation. And so there would be some sort of field representative or the architect himself. It was an architect. Mm-hmm. And then an editor, probably a stylist, certainly one assistant, maybe multiple assistants. And, you'd arrive at the scene and you have to quickly assess the light, the subject, pick an angle, set up the camera, begin to set up lights, remove everything. The poor homeowners, I'm sure, were aghast that all their careful arranging had to be rearranged. Because, of course, everything was directed to the viewpoint of the lens. Mm. So we did a lot of moving around. And then during the shoot itself, there were a lot of props. And there had to be a lot of shifting and moving. So got down to the detail where I can remember my dad behind the lens saying, "All right, move that fork a little bit that way. And, you know, this napkin, just a little bit that way."
Another centimeter to the left.
Getting everything perfect. Right. And so, you know, then, you know, the shutter gets clicked, all the light bulbs get changed. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you get home. And then, you know, comes the next phase of the project, which is to develop the film, go into the dark room, develop the film, inspect the film on a light table, select the image you're going to print, and then go in and then make these prints.
Amazing. I love how I was reading that he appreciated how much creative freedom he had at Eichler Homes and working with the company, And just looking at the photography, for those of you listening, if you go to ErnestBraun.com, you will see all of these amazing, whimsical photos. And he was working with the staff of Eichler Homes. He was working with a realtor that was, you know, Catherine Munson, who was the first Eichler salesperson, is in some of these photos. And she just looks like she's having a blast. And I love how he seemed to be somewhat of a film director, to have that skill to have your subjects feel so free in the movement of these photos. I mean, did you experience that? How he was kind of educating them to the one photo with the woman almost flying into, she's so elevated that she looks like she's going to fly into the window. Capturing those moments is very difficult.
Yeah, and as I said, under the, you know, restrictions of old-fashioned film photography, very much so. But that's really true what you said about freedom to use models and people and photos that Eichler, he talked about that quite a bit. Because, yes, you know, he was doing a lot of work in those days with leading mid-century modern architects in California and elsewhere too. But I think in the architectural world, there was a tendency to like sterile, you know, no people,
right,
kind of austere approach to documentation of the work. But Eichler and his sales agents and the people involved really got on board with the human element, and he really went with that. And I think, you know, being a father of five kids and, you know, spending most of his time in that environment, you know, he was living it.
Yes.
I think he was, you know, able to get his subjects to kind of come alive and you know, express, you know, the feeling of being in a real family, even though they may not even been related. They might have been models.
Right, they were, right.
Sometimes it would have been the homeowner. Sometimes, as you said, it could have been employees, you know, people working for Eichler Homes, or sometimes they did employ models.
But how fun. You can just feel the fun that they had. And I love that about Eichler Homes, the company. I remember Ned Eichler told me before he passed away, he said, we were just doing, everyone was doing their best in their different field, you know, photography, masonry, development, design. Everybody was doing their own thing. Matt Kahn was doing his interiors. And that creative freedom really made it better. It was a work of art in every way. So I love that. And I love that he shared his passion with this, with so many students. I read he had started teaching in the late 1960s. And he led students to expeditions all over the world, to Peru, to New Zealand, Kenya, China. And out of these expeditions emerged seven books. You told me about the seventh. But the six are, and you can find all of these on Amazon, beautiful photography. One is called Living Water. Another one is called Tide Line, Exploring the Pacific Coast Tide Pools. Another one is Grand Canyon of Living Colorado. Another one is Portrait of San Francisco, Oakland, Bay Area. And of course, you can see his work in Paul Adamson and Marty Arbenich's book, Modernism Rebuilds the American Dream. So of his teachings, can you share with us a story about his teaching process and what he how he cared so much for his students?
Well, one kind of humorous story is that, so what we haven't talked about here was, a little bit later on in his career, in the later 60s, I would say, he began to branch out into the natural world. And since we lived in close proximity to open space and parkland in Marin County, you know, we often went on family hikes or to the beach. And later he was exposed to the High Sierra Nevada mountains by his physician and got the bug for backpacking. Mm-hmm. So that really became his passion, was nature photography. He called it environmental photography. So the teaching mostly centered around students in the outdoors and photographing nature. And of course, the magic time for photography in nature is early in the morning and in the evening. Mm-hmm. So they would often, you know, be out with the cameras, you know, before dawn in the early morning, and it would often be really dewy and wet and even frosty. And so, you know, to get these images close up and using close up lenses, and they would be down on their stomachs kind of crawling around. And of course, you get soaking wet. So students dubbed this kind of photography wet belly photography. They even made a bumper sticker for him that said wet belly photography.
That's so cute. Well, some of the photos, and I saw on the website, you can see some of them. It's amazing how he's capturing even the dew on this dragonfly's back, which is just insane to me. And the one that he took that was on the cover of the book Tide Pool is just, I have no idea the length that someone would go to get a photo like that. It's really beautiful. So
let me just, if you don't mind, say something about that particular book. I think what you're referring to is Living Water. Mm-hmm. It was published in 1971, and it really was a groundbreaking publication. I think it was the first book ever to feature photographs that use selective focus and super close-up imagery of the subjects with, you know, a shallow depth of field, out-of-focus background. So, and in fact, it actually won a Time Life Award. And it wound up selling 90,000 copies, which is quite a lot in those days.
Yeah.
For that kind of a book. So it was really a breakthrough book in many ways. Mm. And although he didn't author that book, he did author the following book, which was called Tideline, in which he, in the text, describes one day's change of the tide and goes into, you know, a lot of detail about, you know, the natural history of the coastline, but also about the interaction of humans and man and nature. And so that was a big thing for him. And, you know, another aspect of that was that to find the peace and the quiet to be able to write this book, he wound up renting a place in near Point Lobos, beautiful, which he would retreat to do his writing. Because you can imagine now with 5 kids and a bunch of teenagers and what kind of craziness it was at home.
Right. I'd like to read a quote that he said something beautiful that's really inspiring to me. He said, "While encountering the natural world through the lens, the scene becomes an excellent reminder that I share this earth's environment with all other living things. And I also share responsibility for its well-being. Beauty is an indicator not only of harmonious growth, but something more. It's an essential manifestation of aliveness." I really, really love that. And I love his work around this and his passion around this. Can you share with us maybe one of the most joyful moments that you had with your father? Maybe that was in the dark room, or maybe it was out in the field.
Well, for me, I think the many backpacking trips we did in the Sierra, often just the two of us, were by far my fondest memories of spending time with him. And inevitably, there's a fair amount of adversity, you know, like snowstorms and hail and thunderstorms and crossing rushing streams at great risk. And, you know, you just bond naturally in facing these various challenges. And also, but just sharing the beauty. So like one thing we would do almost every night, as I said, the magic hour is, you know, at dusk and at dawn, you know, we try to take care of dinner chores early to be able to head out and stroll and, you know, look for images as the sun was going down. And I have very fond memories of those walks.
Wow, beautiful. So tell me about Castle and Cook and Sea Ranch a little bit. That must have been an amazing experience.
So, right. People listening may be familiar with a development on the Northern California coast called the Sea Ranch. The development of that project was quite controversial. It was held up for many years due to concerns about public access on the coastline, and ultimately that was resolved, and it exists today. But in the early development of the project, the ad agency that the Castle and Cook Company had hired to promote the development hired my dad to do their promo photos. And luckily for the family, they were kind enough to let him have various rental homes where he could bring, you know, the whole family up there during some of his assignments. So yeah, I have some very nice memories of the whole family at Sea Ranch and, you know, the beach, and, you know, he'd be off shooting. So often, actually, in a number of those photos, my mom and my sister were models. My sister was, you know, big into horses, and so there's, you'll see, if you ever see those advertising photos, people on horseback, well, that would have been my sister.
Oh, that's great. That's so fun. So he was in this wonderful world of modernism. He was friends with Matt Kahn, who was Eichler's interior designer. He was friends with Ned Eichler, Charles Eames. And you can see some of these photos on ErnestBraun.com. But you mentioned that you have a lot of these photos that no one has ever seen.
That's really true. You know, so he was an active photographer for like 70 years.
Yes.
And, you know, he had an amazing work ethic. And, you know, despite, you know, you can imagine the distractions of being a parent, and, you know, he had a lot of other responsibilities. He really produced a lot of work, and there are literally tens of thousands of negatives and color transparencies that we have in the archive. And it's just, it's really a shame that more of them haven't come to light.
Mm. And you have photos of Eames, the studio, right?
Yeah, so yeah, he got to know Charles and Ray Eames and went to their home and studio and photographed them at work. And then, of course, he photographed the work. He did some interesting photos of the Eames chair. Of course, that's probably the most famous item that they made. But, you know, he was also in this circle of artists, and we were talking about this earlier. The sculptor Benny Bufano was a good friend, and he went on some trips to Big Sur to his studio there. And so we have a collection of photos of Bufano at work. You know, he's actually making his sculptures and in his studio in San Francisco. And Lawrence Halperin and Anna Halperin were also good friends, and he extensively photographed the house that Lawrence designed for them in Kentfield in Marin County when it was brand new. And my sister actually took dance from Anna, and over the years he did a lot of photos of Anna Halperin, which are really kind of iconic, I think. Mm-hmm. Very much of the period.
And so he was teaching also. I was very, very touched when I heard about the 55 students that created a portfolio of his work in memory of him. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that's true. I've forgotten exactly the year, but his students amongst themselves organized an exhibit of their work and his work at the Marin County Civic Center, the Frank Lloyd Wright Civic Center, as a tribute to his teaching. And then those images went on to become an online, ongoing exhibit. And each of the students wrote a statement about how my dad had influenced them. Very touching. It was really, the opening was, the celebration was memorable. It's all I can say. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere was just so full of admiration and reverence. Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. And this is such an honor for me to have you here speaking about this. It's just, I know it's emotional and so beautiful and so important, but to see that work and see how it uplifted so many other people and inspired them, it's it's just as inspiring for us to watch that and see that work. I feel that his work is something that every business owner should take into their work ethic and also share with their employees and people that are being involved in anything creative. You have to really be captured by the moment. You have to be captured by the aliveness, as he says, of this work and of people doing any work in design. And I want to thank you so much for coming and for speaking about him. And you actually are in charge of the archives. You're in charge of this amazing legacy. So I really do hope that people get in touch with you to get more photos, to get more prints. And you said you offer different types of prints too.
Sure. Yeah. So previously, through the Eichler Network, he had had an arrangement to provide a dozen or 13 of the kind of Hall of Fame Eichler photos, mm-hmm. made them available as framed prints. And I can certainly continue to provide those photos. We have some, but basically anything that's in the archive, I can, manage mm-hmm. to produce a print. I can make them available for publication through a licensing agreement, which I've mm-hmm. done many times.
Yes.
And I'm happy to talk to anybody.
That's so great. I know we have a lot of listeners that are fascinated with that. And if anyone does want to offer free services to help categorize these tens of thousands of photos, please reach out to Jonathan. That would be amazing.
Well, the challenge is, that everything is digital now, of course. So, mm-hmm. Trying to digitize that much material is just, it's overwhelming.
Right.
So, it's on my agenda to, but I'm actually working pretty much full time. I have my own artistic endeavors. I do ceramics and woodworking and photography as well. So I kind of have a full plate.
Right. Well, we hope to help in that way. And thank you to all of our listeners. And I really urge you all to go to ErnestBraun.com and share in this beautiful, whimsical world of Eichler. Thank you all so much for listening. And thank you, Jonathan.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.